Today we come to our study of Psalm 6. Psalm 6 is another lament psalm, and I confess that my bones have grown weary of the lament of David. However, while these psalms are written in a way that I'm sure were reflections and times of looking back, at least in part, they were a collection of songs that would later be sung by the church that would lift up the goodness and glory of God, much as the song that we just sang. So what we're going to do today is we're going to take the psalm and we're going to flip the story. Rather than focusing on the most obvious subject matter, which is the lament of the psalmist, we are going to focus on the object that he seeks out of that lament. So what is his goal? What is he hoping to achieve? What does he want to find? And where will that be discovered? So here's what happens to us when we go through struggle. Whatever it is, whatever its nature, when we go through struggle, difficulty, hardship, especially if it is prolonged so that it leads to depression, it leads to confusion, it leads to maybe an outburst of anger or maybe an isolation and feeling of being cut off from everybody close to you, a sense of being alone, whatever that is that brings you to that place, keep in mind that everything that is happening to you during that time is specifically designed by evil in order to focus your fullest attention on the problem itself and you. And the only hope that you have in discovering hope itself that will ultimately lead to peace rather than this overwhelming sense of trouble is to shift that focus, at least in part, in a progressive way, away from the problem and yourself, and to shift that toward someone else. What David is going to do is he's going to be so introspective and inwardly focused that he is to the point where he is utterly useless. But through this process of expressing that in prayer, now singing it as a song, he does so in order to release that so that where he ends up is in a place of experiencing God's deliverance. But the deliverance that he experiences is not to give him victory over an enemy or a circumstance necessarily, but it is to bring him back to that centered place that he desires most. And the best word that I can think of to describe that place is the place of peace. What is it that leads us to trouble and causes us to be so disrupted? The circumstances, the situations, the events, the losses, the difficulties, all of these things in life, what are they taking from us? They're taking from us our peace. Now, if we put this into a spiritual perspective and broaden it out of the historical context of Psalm 6, then what we see is that this is the very issue that exists in all people at all times that Jesus died to resolve. Keeping us in perfect peace is the knowledge of faith that we belong to Him and that whatever we experience in this life is indeed temporary, and that which is permanent, that which is the very thing we are moving toward, is going to be peaceful. Now, what does that look like? What does it feel like? I would encourage you sometime to go back and read Genesis 1 and 2 in particular. Read the portions that deal with Adam and Eve and their interaction with God prior to the introduction of sin. What you will discover is the intimacy of a relationship in which they communed with God, they had perfect peace with God, and they had perfect joy and peace with one another. There was no shame. There was no distance. There was no difficulty. The Bible doesn't teach us that it was never going to have any kind of struggle associated with it. It wasn't going to involve any effort on their part or work. But what it does describe for us are the relational issues that were without any malice, without any shame or division, without any subterfuge or deception. There was no lying. There was perfect peace. This is what Jesus has come to restore. We don't experience it in this life. We experience moments of it. But it is in those moments that we are reminded that this is the purpose to which we have been called, and this is the eventual reality in which we will dwell for eternity. So peace is the subject, and the pursuit of peace is the process by which we discover it. Let's look at the pursuit of peace then today in Psalm 6. Keeping in mind that this is something that I have added as a focal point, it is not something stated in the text. The pursuit of peace begins with an understanding of God's mercy. In verses 1 through 3, it says, O Lord, rebuke me not in your anger, nor discipline me in your wrath. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am languishing. Heal me, O Lord, for my bones are troubled. My soul also is greatly troubled, but you, O Lord, how long? When we look at verses 1 through 3, we see a number of things. And a lot of times, especially if you happen to be in a period of difficulty or challenge, when you read verse 1, your thoughts are immediately going to go to, well, God has brought this on me in order to discipline me, or because he's mad at me. And many times, these are the kinds of reactions that we have. If God doesn't hate me, if God isn't angry at me, if God isn't mad at me, then why am I going through this? Why would he allow this? These are all questions that rise up in times of trouble and that frustrate us along the path and the journey to try to answer those or try to find some sort of comprehension. The reason that we struggle with this and the reason that this is so hard is because of the basic flaw that is at the very heart and center of all of these issues, sin itself. And that basic flaw tells us that the world exists for us. It tells us that God exists for us, and nothing could be further from the truth. The reality is that we exist for God. And it's the opposite of the way we oftentimes think about it. And so because we get into this mode of believing that if we are good boys and girls, and if we do what we're supposed to, if we go to church, and if we behave at least when people are watching, then God has an obligation to bless us, and blessing is always going to look like some sort of benefit, protection, healing, restoration, on and on the list goes. The reality is that all of these things are the result of sinfulness. Where does disease come from? It comes from sinfulness. Where does death come from? Death is the end result, and it is in fact an act of God's grace that delivers us from being bound to a life of sinfulness forever without any hope. Where do all of these things come from? Sin and death are our greatest enemies, and they are the very thing that Jesus Christ conquered on the cross, so that when he died on the cross, he paid the penalty of sin. When he rose from the grave, he came out victorious over death. So that by trusting in Christ, by faith, we are experiencing the reality of the reversal of the very thing that keeps us locked. We ask these questions because it's natural to do so. But the reality is that the reason that the answers never satisfy is because it's the wrong question to begin with. The right question isn't why, but how. God, how do I cope with this? God, how do I process and get through this? God, how do I find the strength that comes from you to sustain me in this? It's a much more productive question. It doesn't deny the reality of our pain or our sense of loss, and at the same time, it doesn't fixate on us or the problem. It focuses on God. But it isn't easy. You say, does that mean that every time I've failed, every time I've asked those questions, every time I've lashed out in anger, that God now is going to reject me? No. It means that all of that now becomes a part of the process by which He is growing and sanctifying and leading you to a deeper understanding of truth that is ultimately going to bring you to the place of peace. Again, keep in mind that everything that we learn from God isn't an event, but it is, in fact, a process. The thing that we see in this is mercy. Notice how He speaks of it. Rebuke me not in your anger. Don't discipline me in your wrath. Why? Because He already knows. If God is angry and wrathful toward Him, He is done. Who can stand against the wrath of God? Who can stand against the anger of God? No one. And so what He is crying out for isn't the absence of discipline, or He's not saying, God, don't be mad at me. He is saying, I don't want to be in the position where I would face the full brunt of that because of being cut off from you. If you look at the New Testament, you find numerous passages that talk about how we were once children of wrath. We were once strangers and aliens cut off from God. But now He has brought us into the family of His dear Son. He has made us sons and daughters, children of God. And so we are no longer by faith the objects of wrath, but we are now, rather than that, the objects of love and grace. How did that come to us? Did it come to us because we earned it or deserved it? No, it came to us because of His mercy. And so it is the mercy of God that is the foundation of why we believe that we can ask. That we believe that we can share, that we can cry, that we can scream, that we can do whatever it is that we need to do to express that which is in us in the moments of our deepest hurt. It is the mercy of God that provides us the foundation of hope. Mercy is the very thing that we are to teach and that we are to extend. It begins early as a child when that child misbehaves. And so often times when that happens, that child then is injured. So little children, when they're doing what they're not supposed to, many times what you've told them not to do, what happens? They get hurt. And then what do? See? I told you. Now, I wouldn't want you to give up the intensely satisfying opportunity of doing that. As a parent, you need that every once in a while. I mean, you know, that's what keeps us going, right? But when that child in tears with an injury reaches out for you, you better be sure that there are loving arms to take them up. You can hold them and love them and lecture them at the same time. But don't forget to hold them and love them. God is going to be the reflection of mercy in the back of your mind that you extend in times of pain. Mercy is something that overrides distance and difference. Mercy is something that goes beyond those things that otherwise would drive us apart. And let me warn you, and hear me, without mercy extended through you, you will live your life with its absence in you. You cannot receive mercy if you cannot be merciful. The two are absolutely connected to one another. It is the same concept that we see when we talk about prayer, when we talk about love, when we talk about grace. Jesus says it over and over, love the Lord your God, love your neighbor as yourself. He's saying to us that one is going to automatically produce the other. Loving God, experiencing the mercy of God makes us merciful. If it doesn't, then you're not experiencing it right. Mercy is absolutely essential, so that he would say, rebuke me not in your anger, discipline me not in your wrath, but be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am languishing. Heal me, he says. Heal me, for my bones are troubled. This psalm has been listed among groups of psalms as a penitential psalm. And it means that it would be a song that you would sing as an act of penance for your sin. So it's included in that collection in many historical groupings of this, and some still interpret it that way. I can certainly see why, and there's ample evidence for that. Others, however, look at it no longer as a penitential psalm, but as simply a lament psalm, probably due to a particular illness that the king was experiencing, so that he cries out here for healing. There is simply no way to know. There's no historical context given in or around this psalm that would help us to know exactly what's happening here, what the circumstances are. And so any effort to use that as a foundation for understanding the text is from an argument of silence that is a very uncomfortable place for me to be. However, what I can say with confidence is that he's describing his circumstance not only as an opposition that's coming from an external source, but also as a reality that's rising up from an internal source. And it has created such a troubling of his soul and his spirit that it is affecting him physically as well, to the degree that he would describe his need as one of healing. It's no different than we talk about healing for emotional distress, or healing from grief process, or healing from something of that sort, which may not have a physical manifestation at the time, but is no less real. So he cries out for restoration from God, and he does so on the basis of God's mercy. He focuses his attention back to God. He sees God for who he is, and he calls to God for help. And the help that he seeks is on the foundation of God's mercy. Here's where we flip that story. Be gracious, O Lord, because I am languishing. When he says that my bones are troubled, he's trying to describe a stirring and a disruption of an internal nature that has such depth that it goes beyond the surface of his physical existence to the very center of his structure, his bones. This is often the way the ancients described something that was so deeply ingrained and internalized in what they were experiencing that it went beyond anything they had known before. It was so deep that this is how they described it. My bones are troubled. My soul also is greatly troubled. But you, O Lord, and the sentence is broken and unfinished. You, O Lord, and then there's this, you can almost hear the catch in his voice and the catch in his throat as he can't get the words out. How long? That's all he can say. How long? This is a very dramatic moment, a very deep and a very intimate and personal experience, so that as he expresses this, he is doing so, why? Because he believes God is gracious. He believes in God's mercy. Whatever you're going through, shift your thoughts to the mercy of God. The mercy of God is the very basis by which we come to him, knowing that we receive what we need, not what we deserve. Secondly, notice the love of God. Not only does he depend on the mercy of God, but also the love of God. Verse 4, turn, O Lord, and deliver my life. Save me for the sake of your steadfast love. For in death there is no remembrance of you, and Sheol, who will give you praise? I am weary with my moaning. Every night I flood my bed with tears. I drench my couch with my weeping. My eye wastes away because of grief, and it grows weak because of all my foes. So now he, again, in such dramatic fashion and poetic verse, turns his attention, but he does so in a way that focuses on the love of God. He says, deliver my life and save me for what? Because I'm a great guy? Because I'm the king? Because I want you to? Or because you owe me? No, he says, for the sake of your steadfast love. What is it that's going to come out of this? If God delivers David and if God restores David, what will come out of this? What will be the end result? The end result is the elevation and praise of the steadfast love of God. Steadfast love is a phrase that we see in the Old Testament that gets translated in different ways, but the different ways all bring us back to this same concept. It is a loving relationship that has the strength and stability of determination even when everything else is in turmoil. And so it's talking about a foundational love. It's talking about a true love. It's talking about the kind of love that does not depart even when everything else gets destroyed. We see that love in a modest format. In the love that we have for one another, especially when we go through difficulty. Have you ever noticed sometimes that when you love someone, maybe you're related to them, or maybe you just have known them forever and you've been through a lot together. Maybe you're connected in some other way, but regardless of the nature of the relationship, I don't want that to be the focus. I want the love to be the focus, and then that love gets strained or it gets stretched beyond what it was before, and it grows a little bit indifferent and cold, but then something terrible happens. What rises up? If the love is genuine, that's what will rise up. And it will override and supersede whatever it was that divided. Could even be nothing more than time and distance. But it can restore to a freshness the relationship that once was. Steadfast love of God enables that same quality in us. Obviously to a different degree, but nonetheless, that's the highlight of this section. So that as he seeks deliverance, as he seeks salvation, he says, if I die, he said, then who's going to praise you? I can't praise you from beyond the grave. I want to praise you now. And so what he's pledging to God is the praise of his steadfast love. He's saying, if you deliver me, I'm going to be sure and give you the glory. Is he bargaining with God? Perhaps a little. But have you done that before? I have. What's so different from Moses saying to him, don't destroy these people. Yes, they deserve it. Yes, we all deserve it. But then the enemies who have profaned your name will say, see, God wasn't able to deliver them. Was God being convinced and persuaded to do something that he hadn't already decided to do? I don't believe that for a moment. I believe that the bargaining and the arguing had a lot more to do with the transformation of Moses than it did with the circumstance. I believe that in the same way, this is a means by which God enables us and helps us to kind of process through what we're experiencing to bring us to the place where we realize that what is most important is his steadfast love. Mercy is God's grace that restores and heals. Love is that which we display as God sustains us, even when we are to the point where he would describe himself as soaking his bed and his couch at night with his tears. He is simply wasting away because of his grief and his sorrow and his pain. And it is in the midst of that that he calls out to God, but he does so on the basis of His steadfast love. So as we go through the trials of life, we can focus on the mercy of God and on the love of God so that we experience, thirdly, the deliverance of God. Verse 8 says, "Depart from me, all you workers of evil, for the Lord has heard the sound of my weeping. The Lord has heard my plea, and the Lord accepts my prayer. All my enemies shall be ashamed and greatly troubled, and they shall turn back and be put to shame in a moment." There are two things that I want you to get from this regarding the deliverance of God. And I want you to think of the word deliverance and then put a slash mark at the end of it and add the word salvation. So what that'll do for us, it'll give us a context for this passage from a historical point of view with regard to the psalmist experience, and then it will give us a context from a more current point of view with regard to the gospel and the influence that God has in our lives through Christ Jesus and our relationship with Him. So with that in mind, then notice what he says in verses 8 through 10. He is reminding us of a number of things, but in all of them you see a dramatic shift. So that he says, "Depart from me, workers of evil, for the Lord has heard the sound of my weeping. He has accepted my prayer." What is it has happened? Evidently, nothing's changed. Circumstances are the same. Nothing has changed, but something inside the psalmist has changed. He says, "You've heard me. You've accepted me." In the midst of his prayer, in the midst of his worship, he has experienced the presence of God. He has experienced the grace of God. He has experienced the mercy and love of God in a way that has sustained him, and it has turned his mind and it has turned his emotions so that he now speaks to those who would work against him. And he says, "Depart from me because you can't come and get me. You, on the other hand," he said, "you are going to be the ones put to shame." So the two things that are spoken of with regard to the deliverance is, first of all, the way that he experiences the saving work of God. He is delivered from that which is the circumstance, or at least because of his confidence in God, he knows that that deliverance is in process. But the second thing is that not only does he know that he's delivered, but he says, instead of you railing against me, you're going to be the one put to shame. Now, what were the enemies of David doing? And how were they railing against him? They were saying, "You claim to be anointed by God, but look at what you're going through. You claim to be blessed of God, but look at what you're experiencing. You claim to worship the one true God, and yet he can't even help you in this difficult time." That's what they were saying. Sound familiar? Almost Job-like? Isn't it kind of how we are? We go through hardships and difficulties, and then we don't express any of that pain, and we don't share any of that because we don't want our friends and family members who maybe don't share our faith to know about it, because we're afraid they'll think that our faith is fake. And they'll see in us something that we think isn't going to be a reflection of God. Have you ever thought about that one of your greatest testimonies isn't your accomplishment, achievement, and perfection, but it is your weakness, brokenness, and pain? Where is the greatest testimony? What is the single moment in all of human history that defines for all of us the greatest understanding as well as connection to our God? It is the cross. It is the experience of greatest pain and shame. It is the experience of deepest loss. It is the conflict and clash of sinfulness and perfection brought together in a moment of injustice and righteousness. It is the defining reality for every believer on this planet through all of history, and it is the one thing that is so complete and consequential to all that we know as people of faith that without it, everything else loses meaning. It is the only thing that Jesus instructed his disciples to follow and adhere to, a practice by which they would remember his shed blood and his broken body. Our suffering is not to be hidden from the world. Our pain is not to be something that we withdraw from those around us. It is not something that God has called us to enter into the cave in hiding or to isolate ourselves as though that our suffering and pain cannot be a testimony. But rather what we are doing is that through every single process of life, and perhaps even especially those that are most difficult, we are to declare the deliverance of God. What comes out of this is the reminder that no matter what we encounter in this life, this is not the final word. Jesus is. I know it's easy to get caught up into the situation where, yeah, we know we're going to go to heaven someday, but we're so wrapped up in our lives right now that it's hard to even think about. Just like today, we talk about the passing of loved ones. And we say that it's tragic. And yet, while that is true with regard to the impact that it has in us and the loss that we experience, it is also not true with regard to the hope that we have for eternity. Is that hope real? You know, we've got one of those machines here that if you go into atrial fibrillation or you have a heart attack or something, your heart rhythm is messed up, we can hook you up. And we can shock you back to a correct rhythm. I've been just itching to do that. And we've replaced batteries in that silly thing 2 or 3 times now and still haven't gotten to use it. They just wear out. One day we were having the conversation about purchasing one of those batteries. Mary Ann's in the office. She said, well, I'll tell you one thing. She said, don't you hook me up to that thing. She said, if I go down on the floor, you let me go. Now, to her family, we are going to hook her up. We say whatever she wants to hear when she's looking at us, but we're going to do what we want. We don't know where all the passwords are. We got to hook her up. But I get what she's saying. Guys, what's coming? It is so good that we cannot even imagine it. And it is the awareness of that, that the Spirit abides within us, that gives us that sense of hope, that allows us to stare even death itself dead in the eye. And in that moment, experience peace. Trouble comes. There's no denying it, no running from it, no hiding. It's a reality. And it comes to all. And this life is brief. It's like grass. Rises up quickly and fades even faster. It's a seasonal change in which there is a time for everything, including a time to die. But in the midst of all of that, there should also be the sustaining presence of life-transforming faith that gives us peace. Shift your attention in the midst of your sorrow to the mercy of God, the steadfast love of God, and the delivering, saving power of God. And in those moments, He will give you His peace that will